Hi, everyone. What is the name of our more? Oh, we have a title. It's More Podcast, Less Process.
I think we have to change that title.
Really?
Yeah.
I saw somebody else use the MPLP like joke the other day.
Really?
Yeah.
It's a good title, but it's too hard to say.
It is too hard to say. We need something like more alliterative.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, hello, everyone. This is our Archives podcast coming from New York City. I'm Jefferson Bailey.
And I'm Josh Ranger.
And we do this podcast as part of the Documentary Heritage Program, funded in part by the New York State Archives. So thanks to them. And we're excited for our third quote-unquote episode this week. So I'll let our interviewees introduce themselves.
Our three guests this week, yes, for our third podcast.
Go ahead.
Hello, my name is Ryan Anthony Donaldson, and I'm the Vice President of the Archivist Roundtable of Metropolitan New York.
And I'm Janet Bundy. I'm currently the Director of Outreach and Advocacy for the Archivist Roundtable of Metropolitan New York.
I'm Robin Katz. I'm Outreach and Public Archivist at Brooklyn Historical Society.
Great. And what's our topic this week, Jefferson?
Thank you, Josh. Our topic is archives in education. And so we have Ryan, Robin, and Janet here to talk about two programs that work to sort of bring archives and educators together. So I guess you want to sort of each talk about your respective programs first, and then we'll get into sort of more conversation.
Okay. So the program that Janet and I have worked on the last couple of years is the K-12 Archives Education Institute. And really, this sprang from the desire on the part of the leadership of the Archivist Roundtable to reach out to audiences that may not be familiar with archives or maybe could utilize archives more in their everyday and in the workplace. And one of the audiences that we identified were teachers and educators. And the program, and Janet could be able to speak to it probably more eloquently than I can, was a program that we had wanted to set in place for a long time with this desire to reach out to these audiences, these new audiences. And really what I think it took was having some great partners to be able to, you know, really bring it into fruition. So for the program, we partnered with the National Archives at New York City, as well as the United Federation of Teachers, Associated Teachers of Social Studies. And the program is a recurring program. It's once a year. It's the culminating event of New York Archives Week, which is the second week of October. And the program is designed to bring together local educators and teachers with archivists to discuss strategies for teaching with primary source materials. And with the first institute being in 2010, it also kind of came out of the Common Core, which I'm sure will come up later and also has been in the news lately, being September 2013 as we're recording this. It was also a way to talk about those standards with the educators. And also, I think for archivists, it's been a really interesting experience for them as well to kind of learn more specifically the needs that teachers have and the lack of time they have in being able to prepare primary source documents from archives for students in a variety of settings, whether it's age, whether it's being able to apply it to a specific Common Core requirement, as well as the idea that just text is not something in particular that is something that a teacher would go towards unless there was interpretive content attached to that that was very ready at hand. So we're going to be having our fourth Archives Education Institute coming up in October. And I guess I could turn it to Janet at this point to talk about that as well as some other thoughts on the program.
Sure. So to give you a sense of what the Institute looks like, it's a one-day program, usually lasts about 6 to 7 hours. And while it's changed a bit over the years, generally in the morning we have a panel discussion with local educators and teachers that has consistently been moderated by some of our partners at the National Archives. They're very lucky. We're very lucky to be able to work with their educational staff. to sort of illustrate how primary sources can be incorporated into instruction. And then we break for lunch. And then in the afternoon, local archivists are able to present materials from their collections that relate to each year's theme. Last year's theme was transportation, and this year we're working on a theme of food and foodways, which is pretty exciting. And so local archivists present some of the material from their collections, and then we spend the afternoon broken up into small groups with educators and archivists really working together to wrestle with how to use those documents in the classroom. The event is free. We're very lucky to have support from MetLife for this event. Consistently, we have for the last several years. And again, we do provide breakfast and lunch for all participants. And so that's sort of what the day looks like. And I can say, having participated in all three past institutes, it's the sort of thing that really the day sort of ends abruptly, in the sense that people are still having really good conversations by the end of the day, and you kind of don't want to cut them off, which is a really great way to end any kind of event, I think.
This is Robin again. In my work at Brooklyn Historical Society, I'm co-director of a program called Students and Faculty in the Archives, so I think I'm here to represent the post-secondary end of education and archives. It's a three-year U.S. Department of Ed grant from the now-defunct FIPSE program, but we were funded by the U.S. Department of Education with interest in seeing how archives can benefit students and institutes of higher learning. So we have some great findings. We found that students who participate in SOFA classes are more engaged and perform better than their peers. And I think that's my main takeaway, is that this program has amazing findings that will benefit the archives profession to show our relevancy and to advocate for our use in teaching. What SOFA looks like, it's a three-year grant. We have partners at Long Island University Brooklyn campus, City Tech, part of the CUNY system, New York City College of Technology, and St. Francis College. So they're all within walking distance of Brooklyn Historical Society. And we have 18 partner faculty in a wide range of disciplines, so English, literature and composition, history, but also religious studies, photography, architectural technology. So really a wide range of disciplines and a wide range of types of courses, everything from the first year introductory survey to small curated seminars. We focus on first year undergraduates or early undergrads. And the programs consists of professional development for faculty, as well as in-class visits to the archives. So we have taught over 1,100 students over the past two academic years, over 60 courses. And like I said, we have some great findings. So as the grant wraps up this semester, really, by the end of this calendar year, we hope to have a project-level website that we'll launch with sample curricula, activities, actual exercises that can be done in archives or in classrooms, as well as articles on pedagogy. So it's SOFA in a nutshell. We call it SOFA, Students and Faculty in the Archives.
Well, I guess, you know, that was one of our original questions that Ryan mentioned, just basically Common Core. it's you know, something that's coming up in the news a lot lately and slightly controversial in some areas. And just how does what you guys are doing, how does that fit in with what's going on with Common Core stuff?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's something that, you know, when the Archives Education Institute first started, it was something that was in development. You know, now we're in an implementation phase of it. I believe this year is the first year that it is a statewide requirement to follow this model. You know, in terms of having great partners, working with the National Archives at New York City, you know, they've been working on this as well in parallel. You know, one of the nice things about having this program is it fit in with their educational goals in terms of their education department. We work very closely with the education department there and Christopher Czar, and it was one of those situations where I think as we were trying to build this, we realized there was an education component for the teachers as well, and there was certainly kind of with the way that the curriculum is structured, leaves a lot for interpretation, and also the idea that it was moving to something new, as well as something new that leaves some of the details to be configured by the institution itself, along, you know, the teacher as well as the institution itself. So, you know, in terms of what we have offered on our website, we have worksheets that follow from the Common Core requirements to try to make it more practical. And that was kind of a movement that we've tried to do as well with the materials that the archives are presenting, is, you know, being able to show directly how these archives apply to specific criteria within the Common Core curriculum. And I think that's something that we'll continue to work on and continue to refine. But I think just being able to make that movement to show specific examples of how the archives can apply to fit the curriculum. And that seemed to be something that the teachers who participated were looking for. But I think it's probably going to be a co-educational thing going forward as it's being implemented this year.
Yeah, one of my questions, it was interesting both to hear about the diversity of disciplines that you were talking about and sort of the pre-made interpretive content. So I was curious, like, what are the challenges when you're putting on or building these workshops or institutes for, you know, staying open to a broad range of disciplines and not necessarily just, you know, honing in on Common Core or historian or historical content or genealogical. That seems like very challenging from the archivist side of the table.
I think there's a lot too that I don't think archivists feel terribly confident about their ability to teach or to, I guess, go into a classroom and present their content. I think we represent as art, our members represent all kinds of repositories, some educational, some historical societies, sort of all across the board, and each of those has a built-in constituency. And I think one thing that we've experienced is sort of a hesitancy to go outside that constituency with our members. But one thing that I've always found really interesting in working with the teachers who come to the Institute is their ability to look at a document or to look at a photograph or to listen to a sound recording and think of instantly multiple ways that could be used in their classroom. So I think it's at least from our, you know, very narrow experience at the Institute, I think it's been a learning experience for both sides. And I'd love to hear Robin talk a little bit more about the diversity of faculty that they see, because we certainly see that with teachers, both grade levels and subject. We have pretty much everybody showing up.
I guess now is maybe a good time for me to share a bit about our teaching philosophy that we've developed through this three-year program. I think teaching with archives always has to start with the learning objective of the teacher. And a lot of times in archives, we're looking at collections and trying to see how they fit into classes. When an archivist is working with an educator of any kind, there's a lot of back and forth that goes, you know, the teacher comes to the archives and says, well, what do you have? And we say, well, what do you want? And there's really a tension between how do we make this fit together. What we've come to is that you have to start with really concrete learning objectives. And these aren't just goals, like the idea of my goal is I want students to understand, quote unquote, what historians do, right? But actual objectives, like I want students to understand that the civil rights movement in the North looked a little different than it did in the South. And then we see how collections can fit into that. Our teaching philosophy that has emerged also really favors specific prompts and specific activities. A lot of times in archival education, we're used to a very generic, like, who was the creator? How old is this document? What kind of document is this? Which is actually a very difficult question to answer in many cases. So starting from those learning objectives, seeing what collections fit the class needs, and then building specialized activities around those, which takes a lot of time, takes a lot of investment on the time of an educator and an archivist, and actually requires doing research in a somewhat new way for a teacher. You know, when I work with college faculty and they do their own research in an archives, if they've done it, and that's an issue that comes up with different disciplines, they're used to wanting to uncover every stone and to really be comprehensive. But when you're teaching, you're actually just looking for an illustrative example, a good document. So those are the kind of issues that we've worked through, but we really favor specific prompts. So the pre-made issue is difficult. I guess our goal at this point is to provide more sample activities to show models and tools and ways of using archives, you know, structures to use, and then for teachers to apply them in their their own context for their own needs. If that answers the question.
Yeah,
definitely.
Okay. that makes me think of something, what you were saying about how the teachers come and say, you know, what do you have, the kind of the what do you want thing, and just wondering about how archives are used, and you know what, and also like how archives are structured in a way, especially with a lot of stuff around it focused on the researchers, and you know things are geared towards a researcher coming in and doing a certain thing, doing a certain way, and we make finding aids or whatever it is that are, I guess, funnel things as a certain way of doing things. so is there, have you been finding that, you know, that I guess you have been, but I guess talk about this more, that, you know, there's like a step of educating, like that people, you know, do people feel there's a barrier against archives? What is, you know, do they know what an archive is, or how you engage with it, or, you know, how you look for stuff kind of thing? Like,
well, the doors are locked, so yeah. That doesn't tend to help. We have, over the past couple of years, developed an introduction to the Institute that would sort of precede the panel discussion in the morning that does, in 10 minutes or less, try to communicate what archives are, how they're structured, and how you can find information in them. And it's not intended to be, you know, an explication of the finding aid as a document, but just a little bit more background in this is how we run our shops, and this is how we want to get you in the door kind of thing. And that actually, that part of the Institute, I'd say definitely in the last 2 years, has a super long Q&A after it. A lot of the teachers are really responsive to that introduction, and I don't mean to say that just because I'm the one who's doing it, but they really are interested in how we're set up and how they can access what we have. And I'm sure, you guys, Robin, must do a ton of that too, just sort of intro to Archives 101 kind of thing.
Yeah, we're a little different in that we have this cohort that we've worked with over time, and like full disclosure, these faculty also get stipends for their participation in this really time-intensive grant. So we are not necessarily a representative example, and that aspect of SAFA cannot necessarily be, is not exactly portable. But I think there are two aspects that apply to everyone. To some extent, as an archivist or the liaison with the archives, we have to interpret a little. We have to, finding aids and subject guides only go so far, and only a certain kind of researcher will necessarily find what they need through that. There has to be a bit of collection highlights, a bit of suggestions, a bit of pointing in the right direction. If you can do that in person and physically show stuff, that's great to get someone started. The flip side of that is that we also really ask a lot of our faculty, of our educators. We actually ask them to, from that, make time to come into the archives, sit down themselves, identify what documents they want to use. And so I think it really is a push-pull, a meeting in between of, you know, I can suggest some great things we used last term, but you also have to kind of wrestle with this and figure out how it'll work for you. But, you know, it's interesting if you think about exporting this model to busy people who don't have time and aren't being paid to be in the archives. And that's a question we have to answer.
So what is an archive? That's a good question. I think this is, you know, we have, you know, representatives from very different archives here, or people who engage with archives in very different ways, from, you know, corporate to historical society. We mentioned NARA. You know, these are very different structures that we're all putting under this model of an archive. And so I guess I'm just wondering, you know, how does that kind of thing fit into to educating with archives?
That's actually the first step, I think, is explaining the variety of repositories that you could encounter. Everything from a website to an historic house to an institutional repository to a museum archive. All of those repositories have material that teachers can use, and I'd say at any grade level, whether you're K through 12 or teaching at the undergraduate or graduate level. And so once you've been able to sort of say, all of these things can be an archive, and these are, you know, sort of what records are and how they get produced and what happens to them before they come into a repository, what we do with them when they get there, how we describe them so that people can use them, and then how we try to get them in the hands of people that can use them. I think that sort of gets people's brains going a little bit, insofar as they can in the morning after some coffee, you know. And I think if that were the only takeaway from the Institute, then I would be happy to sort of get people thinking about the relevance of archives and where they might be hiding, if you can use that word.
No, you can't. They're unhidden.
Well, what do you think are the greatest misconceptions that people bring in before they, you know, before they get this exposure to the diversity of repository types and record types and uses? Like, do people come in with misconceptions, or, I mean, they must to some extent, or they're just totally ignorant of what archives are?
I think one thing I've observed is the accessibility issue, that for some of the educators coming in, really, you know, realizing that some repositories that, you know, like an educational repository, academic institution, thinking that it only is for the student body, and being able to say, well, no, you know, this collection is made accessible, you know, here's, and this is something where I think archivists can really step into, is promoting the collections and talking about how they can be accessible to audiences outside of what's deemed the primary audience. Because once that's revealed, I think that's a revelation for, you know, at least some of the teachers that participated, and some of the follow-up was, that we got back was, when they had time, the educators, you know, reaching out to those repositories and being able to make further connections. We had a really good connection one year with the archives of the Girl Scouts of the USA, with some educators, and they were able to follow up following the Institute. So I would say the accessibility one is one that definitely comes to mind pretty strongly for me. And I think, you know, Janet does a wonderful job of being able to, you know, talk about the types of repositories, you know, get into access, and then in a very short amount of time, talk about what it is that we do. You know, I think when we kind of look critically at the program and think about how we can make it better, we realize that 6 or 7 hours really isn't enough, that if we can build this to be something larger, to really have some preliminary sessions. We've definitely talked about it on the archivist side. And one of the things that we distribute that the education staff at National Archives created is what is a teachable document, which I think we at the start of the Institute handed that out at the beginning, but we realized we actually should distribute that well before the archivists consider if this is something they want to join in, because it does get to, you know, from a teacher's point of view, an educator's point of view, it gets to, you know, things to look for that will help engage the students. And so now we have that beforehand, and even looking at, you know, ways of being able to have some type of conversation or interaction with the archivist before to prep them, so to speak, you know, coming into it, so that they're more aware of the expectations that are there and have more of a sense of the point of view of the teachers and educators.
I think another thing that you get is that people think it's just for history teachers, that other disciplines aren't represented in the archives, or that educators who focus on, you know, for example, maybe are working with students whose primary language isn't English, that there's not going to be anything there for them. And I think that's something we try to stress, that there are not only multimedia items, but, you know, almost, not every repository, but a lot of repositories are going to have items that are not in English, or that are in different languages. Simultaneously, so that's another thing. I think access is the primary one, that archives aren't for me, but I think the secondary is it's just for history people, or people who are interested in history and no one else.
I will say, following up on what Janet was saying earlier about how much we can talk about archives, how much we can teach our audience about archives, because our program really focuses on document analysis skills and on using primary sources to build certain kinds of information literacy skills, sometimes we actually skip over what are archives to some extent and really focus on what is this document and how do we use it. And so we always have to make a judgment call about how much we can go into. And the more we work with a class or the more we work with faculty, the more interested they become in, oh, what is this digitization thing? And let's talk about that and various like aspects of archives that are interesting, but we don't always really talk about arrangement and description, you know, or get into that. And I think that's mostly because for our program, we're pre-selecting documents, putting them out on the table, and talking about how to use them. We're not necessarily teaching students to identify and locate archival material. So that's a very big learning objective difference I'd want to kind of point out. We focus on document analysis. But it's interesting in that, you know, we kind of sometimes have to jump into it. Time is so short, as you were saying, when you have an introduction with a group of people, how much can you actually get into? And sometimes we have to kind of skip over that. I will also say about the misconceptions issue, I actually think a faculty have a lot of misconceptions about the ability of their students. So coming into this program, we heard from museum educators, from parents, from teachers, from faculty, students can't read cursive anymore. They don't teach cursive in schools. Students can't read cursive. And, you know, we've been using 18th century documents with students in a hard-to-read hand. And we found that it takes a little patience, it takes a little teaching of decoding skills, maybe pointing out some different letters. But students can read handwritten old documents, even if they haven't learned cursive. So that overcoming those kinds of barriers, actually, mostly from educators, sometimes from students themselves as well, not necessarily having confidence. I think a lot of educators also are nervous about what their students will do to a document. Really like the, you better not let my students touch this, right? And then we, you know, what we do focus on in our limited time is care and handling. And how do we treat these documents with respect? What can we touch? And we haven't had any problems, I have to say.
In my day job is actually at NYU, and I find that's exactly true, that students are incredibly respectful of the materials when they get to handle them. And I'd say almost the more fragile a document is, or perhaps we're, you know, working with like leather-bound ledgers and you've got a lot of sort of deteriorating binding or what have you, that the students really get excited about the fact that they're allowed to touch them. Mm-hmm. And in Absolutely. Because of that, sort of do so very carefully. And it's always really great to see that engagement, which I think extends most of the time then to the content, but that engagement really is sparked by the physical object, and that they're like, oh, I can't believe you're letting me do this. They also get really excited about the white gloves. If you let them use those, they're just totally stoked.
That is something we have to clarify, and this depends on each reading room's policy, of course, but the idea that white gloves are really only for photographic prints
right.
in our archive, and that not everything.
Yeah. Right. No, we're not handing them out, misconception. Yeah. But they still, that to them is like a, got to the white glove level.
Well, I think it's that excitement about coming into an archives, like going somewhere that's new and different, being able to use documents that don't just look like a textbook, that engagement, that's why we teach with archives.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, you just answered, so we can stop the podcast now.
So do you get like continued engagement beyond obviously your respective programs? I assume you probably have a lot of students that continue to come into the archive, and you'll communicate with K-12 teachers after the institute's over. So do you just want to talk about how that a little bit, and how that is different than the actual programmatic elements of your programs? Or if it's a bad question, I can think of another one.
I guess I would say that, so every year, I think as I mentioned earlier, the Institute has a different theme. And we have, I don't think we anticipated this at the beginning, but we have repeat attendees. And that's really affirming. And there's educators that have come, you know, for multiple years who've come back to speak on the morning panel based on, you know, I wouldn't say just, you know, their experience with the Institute. They certainly have things they're doing sort of outside of our ken that they present on, but there's people whose dedication to the Institute is you know, like ours, which has been a really great experience to see that people really are taking something of value out of this day. Yeah,
I mean, there's not, you know, we're not able to offer stipends. There's not a lot we're able to offer beyond continuing education hours, which it's then the responsibility of, you know, that particular teacher to then, you know, follow up and you know, complete whatever forms are necessary. So, you know, it really is I think the teacher's own professional interest that really, you know, drives them to join and to continue to be involved. You know, Janet's totally right. We were not expecting anyone to come back to us in following years, but happily that's not been the case. And, you know, that's a challenge that we're facing is how to continue the conversation once the program is over. We've talked about, you know, virtual ways of being able to keep in touch, through a website, through other means of communicating. I think one thing that at least I've come to realize is being able to meet in person really is a different experience. There's a way in which especially once we get to the afternoon group activities, there's a way in which there's kind of a spontaneity to the proceedings, and intentionally leaving the afternoon exercises a bit open-ended to allow for that. We definitely have an objective and a goal to be able to work with the material that we have to present to them from the representative archives, but just kind of walking around the room, the conversation, will go in different directions and having kind of those moments of serendipity. But it is certainly something that as we look to build the program in the future, that we're finding to be a challenge is, once everyone leaves that day, how do we check back in? We do have a survey, but, some more long range tools. It's been a year you came to the Institute, or is there anything that you found most valuable or still using the classroom? Those kinds of metrics I think would be helpful for us.
So in our program, the experience of a student is being in a course and coming into the archives 1 to 3 or 4 times, depending on the class. They might come in once, they might come in 3 times. We have built in some ways in the program for students who are engaged to come back. And I could talk for a while about the advisability of whether or not you have students return to the archives on their own. There are ways to do it and to structure it in a productive way. And there are ways where it doesn't necessarily lead anywhere or add much and is a little more work than it's worth on the part of the archives. So we think about how to tell students to come back and whether or not to in the context of this course. Of course, we end every session with here we are, here's what we do in the future. If you're interested in any of these topics or things, come back to us, talk to us, here's how you make an appointment. It's mostly talk to us and we'll help you get through those next steps. One of my favorite parts about our program is we did build in an opportunity for the creme de la creme, I guess. We see over 600 students a year in this grant. And then in the summer, we had a 5-week fellowship opportunity for some of those students to apply, spend, in-depth time in the archives, do their own individual research project. That's where we build on their skills a little more. So in our program, we had kind of a next step for students as well. Of course, word has spread and lots of other faculty who aren't on the original grant want to participate. And actually right now as our grant ends, we're working on transitioning this experience into the everyday work of BHS. So my colleague Liz Call, our special collections librarian, who does other teaching in our archives, will facilitate the faculty from SAFA and others. And so it's actually been a really interesting conversation to think about. How do you take a short-term grant with a lot of funding that's going to have some great findings, and how do you work that into the seamless, everyday experiences? I think like putting finding aids up online or like digitizing materials, doing great teaching is going to get you noticed, and more people are going to be knocking on your door and asking to come do the same thing. So you have to kind of be prepared for the great outreach that you're doing to have results that you have to then be able to have the resources and staff to support. So.
Yeah, so what recommendations would you have for archives that are looking to get more engaged? I mean, I think there's a great advocacy element, which you talked about at the beginning, and engaging with audiences that might not necessarily be part of your typical constituency. So it seems, a very elemental and beneficial program for any repository to have, regardless of how scaled up or scaled down it is. So for ones that do not have these, but are listening to this podcast and are so excited that they want to start one, sort of what guidelines, would you give them, or what words of advice or, issues to think about that might not be, immediately obvious?
Start small, I guess. Mm-hmm. So it's better to do something well than, to do too much. Always keep those learning objectives in mind. What are you really trying to get at here? Because all decisions should kind of come back to that. I think as an archivist, don't be afraid to ask much of an educator. You don't want to ask too much, and that's a fine line, but you can ask that they give you material, whether it's, I need to see your syllabi, or I need to see the assignment, I need you to come into a meeting, I need to have a phone conversation with you before you show up. Don't be afraid of giving kind of criteria or deadlines to educators. And then my main piece of advice really is to do something and then do it again. the small tweaks, the little improvements are where you really grow the most. So if you're planning on doing a class, plan on doing it two semesters in a row so you have the opportunity to kind of tweak and improve.
Well, that took everything I was gonna say. I guess if you are not currently doing outreach to teachers, again, at any grade level, to sort of think about, okay, well, who's nearby? If you're a small historical society out on Long Island, what's the nearest school? What's the nearest college or university? Could you meet with, try to set up a meeting with some faculty or with some librarians? Think about your collections. Who would want to use them? What topics do they cover? And then sort of proceed from there. We also, the Archivist Roundtable, always loves to have, to have members submit ideas for programming or presentations. Mm-hmm. So if you want to get involved with us, that would be another wonderful thing that you could do.
Yeah, I mean, I think starting a small model, looking locally, I mean, those things definitely make a lot of sense. In terms of, being able to add to that, I think, really kind of thinking about strategically about the conversations you're going to have, really prepare the elevator speech a lot. and I think terms that make sense to archivists won't necessarily translate as well. So
true.
As much as we adhere to the definition of a finding aid, just being able to find other ways of describing that to an educator, well, it's a guide to let us know what we have. Really trying to find ways to express yourself to educators, even to students directly, that doesn't have intimidating language, I think. Or if you're able to use one of the a professional term, also at the same time being able to have a quick and ready explanation, because you really don't want to cause people to turn off by using those terms. But we also want to talk about what we do and the importance of that. So kind of striking that balance.
So don't say provenance.
Well, yeah, right. Or like you're saying, if you do, you have to explain what that means.
And why it's important, I think, especially for something like provenance. Well, why would anyone care? Well, there's a lot of reasons you might care. But
I think when it comes time to planning the teaching session as well, clarifying with the educator what you're going to do, what they're going to do, whether it's like, okay, I'll give this intro, then I turn the class over to you, and then I take it for the end of the wrap-up, or are we both going to be floating during this time? Are we both going to be with small mm-hmm. sessions? Just really spelling out who does what.
And also where. Mm-hmm. So when I've done instruction both in the classroom and then brought students to the archives, and that sometimes I think instructors have a different conception of where this is going to take place, but oftentimes, I mean, your reading room is too small to accommodate an entire classroom full of students, so then what do you do? So that's another thing just to very basically clarify along with all the other stuff that Robin mentioned.
So, and if I'm remembering right from the presentations I've seen before, that part of the Institute is creating curricula that comes out of it, so actually during the day you create stuff using materials, create mm-hmm. curricula that teachers use. It's an interesting thing. Are there plans to try and expand that out, like to get other people to use them outside of New York, or develop that more?
We would love to be able to do that. We're currently in an editing phase for last year's curriculum. I think that's something that we'd certainly like to expand, but that requires a lot of input and a lot of cooperation. Sure. I mean, we'd love to have people outside of the geographic area begin to use the exercises that our participants are able to create. But we do, at least right now, based on, sort of our abilities, have a very specific focus on the New York City metropolitan area for our participants and definitely for the materials that are being presented.
Everyone should care about that.
In an amazing sort of, 5 years down the road, I'd love to have that structured out. But again, it also depends on what your resources are and what you can do, and sort of planning something that's feasible before moving on to the next step.
Yeah. So, Robin, what's the sort of long-range plans with the curriculum that are being developed out of SAFA?
Sure. So we're actually, my co-director and I are taking a little break from teaching this semester as we wrap up this grant. And as we partly work on transitioning over to full-time permanent staff as well. We're focusing really on dissemination. So we'll be publishing and presenting a lot. And one of our real main goals, like I said, is this project level website. So later this fall, you can look at safa.brooklynhistory.org and see, like I said, articles as well as sample exercises. Now working with college faculty is a little difficult because the word like curriculum kit or teaching kit, these turn off college faculty, unlike K-12 teachers who are maybe actively looking for great teaching kits or curricula. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a balance because at the same time, teaching faculty love to see other people's syllabi. They love to see examples. So we struggled with the right wording, but again, just putting out as many models as we can to show different structures, different types of classes, how we use, and just give people an idea, spark them thinking, how can I use the collections near me for my class? I'll say we also are, so we have three main audiences for this upcoming website. Locally, of course, people actually interested in coming to BHS and using the archives and teaching beyond the scope of this grant. Educators nationwide, faculty who can look at these sample activities, as well as librarians and archivists and museum educators nationwide. So we'll be providing a lot of project documentation about the how do we do it, the collection management, the back end kind of thing that we don't always get into with our teachers, but that people like us will care about.
Mm-hmm. So, another thing that this brings up is the importance of, outreach. Like, this is really, it's not just education, it's we're doing outreach, or you guys, sorry, not me. I'm trying to glom on here. you're doing a lot of very important outreach about archives, about collections to the public. Janet, you mentioned Archives Week, which mm-hmm. is coming up in October.
Right?
Yes. I guess, this is another area that's about outreach. I was just wondering if you could talk about that a little bit and explain what's going on with that.
So Archives Week this year is going to be October 6th through 12th of 2013. The Institute will be on the final day. But that's really just a week of activities that are both located in and promote the knowledge about the existence of and the use of archives. And there's all kinds of events that are going to be scheduled. We have our award ceremony scheduled. There's going to be a symposium that ART is hosting. And all of those are ways to sort of get knowledge about the work that we do here in the city out to people who are interested, members of the public who might never have walked into an archive, or people who are professionally active and just kind of want to know what their peers are doing at other institutions. In terms of how we get information about the Institute out to potential participants, I think over the last several years, we've really benefited from one of the more basic forms of outreach, which is honestly word of mouth. Mm-hmm. We've had a lot of teachers who've enjoyed their experience and gone back to their schools and said, hey, I did this thing and it was pretty cool. And then we've had people come to us and say, one of my colleagues said this was really great, so I came, the following year. And we send out, the application. We circulate that to the Museum Educators Roundtable, to all kinds of listservs that are professionally adjacent to archives and to educators. But word of mouth actually really, really works. So kind of like Robin said, if you do something small but you do it well, people will take note and tell other folks about it, which is great.
Absolutely.
Is there anything else you would like to talk about?
Yeah, any burning archival issues that
Do you have any films you're in that are being released soon? Or new albums?
Not this year. Perhaps in the future. Look out soon for some of our findings from our project.
Yeah.
Okay.
I look forward to it.
Can you give some website information again, just to repeat?
Yeah, sure. So launching later this fall, safa.brooklynhistory.org.
And if you're interested in more information on the Archives Education Institute, you can go to our website, which is www.nycarchivists.org, and follow the links to AEI.
And that's also for the Archivist Roundtable, right?
Yes, that's the Archivist Roundtable main website.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah.